the best of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mueller Program. This is Memorial Day 2005, May 30, a day of national observance and a national holiday. And I hope you and your family have been celebrating this holiday, but I hope it's not only a day off. I hope you are taking seriously what it means for this nation to commemorate those who died in liberty service. It was General Order No. 11, handed down by General John A. Logan of the Grand Army of the Republic, that gave birth to what we know as Memorial Day. It was originally known as Decoration Day. Let me read to you the order from 1868. The 30th of May, 1868, is designated for the purpose of strewing with flowers or otherwise decorating the graves of comrades who died in defense of their country during the late rebellion and whose bodies now lie in almost every city, village, and hamlet churchyard in the land. In this observance, no form of ceremony is prescribed, but posts and comrades will in their own way arrange such fitting services and testimonials of respect as circumstances may permit. That was in 1868. General Order 11 stipulated only one day of national observance. But when General James Garfield, later President of the United States, gave the opening Decoration Day speech, what we would now know as a Memorial Day speech, at Arlington National Cemetery, he set a precedent that later presidents and later national officials have followed, and it was in 1971, notice over 100 years later, that the United States Congress declared Memorial Day a national holiday to be celebrated on the last Monday in May. Now, there is a distinction between Memorial Day and Veterans Day. Veterans Day, held every year on November the 11th, is a day to honor those who are living veterans of America's wars, of America's military actions. Memorial Day is a little bit different. The very word memorial indicates that these are persons who live now only in memory. These are those who died in liberty service. I think it would be good for us to remember just how many of these there were. A little history lesson never hurts on a day like this, just to be reminded of the price that has been paid in the blood of American citizens, soldiers, sailors, and airmen. In the American Revolution, 1775 to 1783, approximately 4,435 Americans in uniform died. 4,435. In the War of 1812, the casualties were 2,260. In the Mexican War of 1846 to 1848, approximately 13,000. In the Civil War, Union forces 646,000 and Confederate forces 134,000. In the Spanish-American War in 1898, approximately 2,446 dead. But just wait until the 20th century. World War I, 116,708 American dead. World War II, 407,316 Americans died in both the Atlantic and the Pacific theaters. In the Korean War, 1950 to 1953, 36,512 dead. In the Vietnam War, 58,193 dead. In the Persian Gulf War, 148. In the War on Terror, several and still counting. The Iraq War, 1,606 as of the first week of May of this year. Now, you add all that up, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of American lives. You're talking about a price that was paid not merely with tax dollars, not merely with time, not merely with devoted energy, but with lives. Even now in Iraq, there are Americans in uniform, Americans in our name, fighting for democracy and for freedom, fighting wearing our uniform and deserving our hope and prayer. And we need to remember that there are families across this country with fresh grief. There are freshly dug graves where young Americans now lie, having given their lives in the cause of this nation, in the cause of freedom, in the cause of liberty. Memorial Day is an important national observance. We should remember that one of the greatest addresses ever given by President Abraham Lincoln was given as he led the nation to remember the price that had been paid by others in order that we would know liberty. Abraham Lincoln said in his famous Gettysburg Address, "We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that this nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but can never forget what they did here. That is the true spirit of a Memorial Day observance. The poet Will Carleton, he was, by the way, the poet laureate of Michigan at the turn of the century, he said, speaking at the Civil War Memorial, "Cover them with beautiful flowers. Deck them with garlands, these brothers of ours lying so silent by night and by day." You know, Memorial Day is more than a national holiday. As a nation, we must be reminded again and again that our freedom was bought with a price. Throughout the history of this republic, soldiers, sailors, and airmen have given their lives for the sacred cause of liberty. Our honored dead lie in cemeteries all over the nation and scattered around the world. Even now, freedom is defended at great cost. The story of American freedom is the story of noble and sacrificial service. On Memorial Day, we honor all those who have given their lives for this nation and its ideals, and we pray for those who fight in our stead even now. You know, some years ago, my wife and I were traveling from France to Great Britain. We were going to England across the English Channel. We were caught in a storm, and in the midst of that storm in the ferry, it was a pretty rough ride, and we were looking out and seeing the storm as it was breaking there on the French coastline. And at one very spectacular moment, the clouds began to part, and a shaft of light began to come down on the hills and on the cliffs where American soldiers and their allied comrades had landed on D-Day. And at the top of that cliff, there stood an American flag. A reminder that Americans had fought and died in this place. A reminder that thousands of Americans are indeed buried atop those cliffs. They're on French soil. All over the world, you can find cemeteries where American dead lie honorably buried. And you know, they, in terms of their names, in terms of their rank and their serial numbers, may be known only to those descendants who hold them in personal memory. But for all of us as Americans, today is a reminder that it is our responsibility to hold them in our collective memory, to make certain that there is no soldier, no sailor, no airman, no American in uniform who died in our place, who died in our cause, who is not remembered and remembered with honor. Memorial Day used to be called Decoration Day because it was when Americans went out to decorate the graves. Some of that will go on today as formal observances will be held, ceremonies will be conducted, and bouquets of flowers and garlands and wreaths will be put upon graves. But we need to remember that we decorate those veterans and we memorialize them on Memorial Day, not so much by putting flowers on the graves, but by dignifying the cause for which they served. You know, the greatest indignity, the greatest tragedy that we could allow to befall those who have fallen in our stead is that we forget them, is that we act as if democracy is something that has been handed to us by history's platter, that we neglect to understand that a price was paid and even now is being paid. An amazing report has come out of the Pacific, where in the Philippines we are told that there are at least 2 and perhaps as many as 40 Japanese veterans of World War II still hiding out in the jungles. They weren't told that the war is over. They were afraid of going back to Japan and being tried for treason. The Philippine government is trying even now to figure out how to make contact with these octogenarian veterans of a war they don't even know is over. You know, there's something in their consciousness that can be corrected by perhaps just being taken back to Japan to see what that nation now represents long after the war we know as World War II is over. But maybe we as Americans need a wake-up call of our own to know that even as the world has changed and even as history has moved forward, it has done so because before us there have been generations willing to pay a price to make sure that this nation is secure and strong and free. To make certain that in this generation we will not have to pay precisely the same price against precisely the same enemies that previous generations so nobly paid in battles that were so nobly fought. But we've been handed our own challenges. And this is the time for our generation to recognize that Memorial Day is one of those catalysts in our own consciousness to remind us of our ongoing responsibility. Celebrate Memorial Day with your family. Enjoy a picnic. Enjoy a day of holiday. Perhaps, and I hope for you, a day off from work. But don't let it just be a day off. Let it be a day of meaning and memory as well. Fathers, mothers, take your children to a cemetery and let them see those tombstones. And let them see the American flag waving in the sky. We'll be back in just a moment for a classic Albert Mueller program. This one on the question, should parents be licensed? If you think that's just a hypothetical question, you need to stay tuned. This is something you won't want to miss. I'm Albert Mueller.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. You know, I've been hearing some conversation about this particular topic, so I decided I was going to go out and find out what kind of literature was out there and, what kind of activity was found among academics and public policy people. The question is, should parents be licensed? And I want to tell you how this came about. It really has come about because of the new reproductive technologies, because just follow the logic here. You have these new in vitro technologies and you have all these advanced reproductive technologies. I mean, after all, we've been talking on this program about, a 60-plus-year-old woman who had a baby and all these issues. And so equity becomes the issue and fairness and justice. And the question comes down, who should have access to these new reproductive technologies? And so in Great Britain and in Canada and in the United States, there are those who are arguing over, well, should it be a couple? Should it be a healthy person? I mean, is it moral for an unhealthy person to have a baby if the unhealthy person isn't going to live long enough to nurture the baby? Or an elderly person, an older person, like what we dealt with this Romanian woman who had a baby and is obviously probably not going to live to see that baby become an adult? So those were the questions that kind of first raised the issue of authorizing people to have access to these reproductive technologies. But then there's another issue that comes up, and you can imagine where this is coming from. There are those who think that parents, just by normal reproductive capacity, ought to have to get a license in order to have a child. And I thought this would be a fascinating topic for our conversation today. It is the subject of my commentary published today at albertmueller.com, Should Parents Be Licensed? And it's also the topic of a new book, the title, as a matter of fact, of a book by Peg Tittle, who is a moral philosopher and ethicist, and she has collected an assortment of articles, book chapters, and other writings on these issues, and it makes for fascinating reading, and it is a haunting story. The background to all this begins about 25 years ago when a professor by the name of Hugh La Follette wrote a book entitled Licensing Parents. It was published by Princeton University Press. So this isn't some fringe out there. This is Princeton University Press. And in it, he argued that the parents should be licensed because, as he says, any kind of profession at which there is the danger of risk to others, there ought to be regulation. Just listen to this. He says, our society normally regulates a certain range of activities. It is illegal to perform those activities unless one has received prior permission to do so. We require automobile operators to have licenses. We forbid people from practicing medicine, law, pharmacy, or psychiatry unless they have satisfied certain licensing requirements. Thus, any activity that is potentially harmful to others and requires certain demonstrated competence for its safe performance is subject to regulation. That is, it is theoretically desirable that we regulate it. Well, there you can see the ideological foundation for a movement to license parents and to require them to be licensed. Now, how would this work? Listen, I've been reading the literature, and it's scary stuff. I'm just going to give you just kind of a bird's-eye view of what's going on with this. First of all, you have some radical feminists who are arguing that that they ought to have basic control over this entire process and that feminist concerns ought to drive this. You have population control people, and by the way, we know how out of step that now is in a world that's going to have a declining population very soon, and especially in advanced democracies where we're not even replacing ourselves. But they're arguing that in order to control the population, persons ought to have a license to have a child. But the real issue here is an even deeper ideological concern with those who don't like conservative parenting and those who suggest that people ought to have a limited number of children so that they can't overbreed It's really a eugenics movement. We've talked about that before, of the right people having the babies according to whatever worldview you have. And that was a central doctrine of Nazi Germany and a concern of Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood. One of her mottos was more children from the fit, less from the unfit. And by the way, some of the authors in this book, edited by Peg Tittle, suggest that, well, of course, you ought not to allow this license to persons who would be sexist and who would raise children to be sexist, raise children to follow male and female stereotypes. There are others who would say, you know, you shouldn't allow persons who would be biased against gays or homosexuals to have such a license. There are others who are saying, look, a parent or would-be parents ought to be required to go through some regulated, bureaucratically controlled parenting class at the very minimum. And there are others who say, look, the license actually ought to be just for a specific period of time. You can have the baby and you can keep the baby, but then you have to go on and you have to get successive licenses in order to keep the baby. And continuing education and all the rest. And, of course, the people who are pushing this are able to point to specific and tragic cases of parental abuse and say, look, that wouldn't have happened if we licensed the parents. And we required only people who would be fit for parenting to have this. Now let me just get to the bottom line here very quickly. Number one, I think this is impractical. It isn't going to work. Who's going to come up with the criteria? Who's going to enforce it and all the rest? But the second thing I want to tell you is just because it won't work just doesn't mean it won't be tried. And it doesn't mean that there won't be horrible damage done in the name of protecting children by licensing parents. The next thing I want you to know is, and please hear me clearly, the ability and liberty to procreate is one of the main checks against the totalitarian power of the state. That is one thing the state cannot control, and it must not control. And it is one of the checks for liberty against totalitarianism. And when the state tries to control something as intimate and as personal as breeding, as procreating, as having children and raising those children, we're in big trouble. You see, there is a prejudice right now. There is a basic respect for parental authority right now in the law. And there are those who are adamantly opposed to that. There is an entire army of social workers and therapists and you name it, educators and bureaucrats who want to remove that bias toward parental authority and parental sovereignty. Right now, the court or whoever brings the attention to the court has to have some compelling reason for parental authority to be taken away or compromised. But there are those who are making very serious arguments in law schools and in the public square and in think tanks and in legislatures that this ought to be reversed, that the bias ought to be that there is no parental authority unless the court grants or the government grants that parental authority. Folks, we're in big trouble if this kind of idea takes much hold, but it should be frightening enough that a book like this has already been published, and we're now decades into a conversation that most Americans are not even aware of. Thus, we're talking about it today on the Albert Mueller Program, and I want you to join this conversation. Our phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Should parents be licensed? I want to know what you think about it. You know, there may be some people out there who think, hey, that'd be a good idea. That way we could require parents to have training and to be certified. Can you imagine living in a society where you have certified parents? Excuse me, that baby, do you have a license for that baby, sir? Now, for crying out loud, you know, pull that stroller over to the curb. I want to see your license, registration, insurance, and all the rest. Now, some of the statements made in this book are absolutely frightening, such as, There is one statement against religious parents, and that's us folks, Christian parents in particular, who would raise their children by Christian prejudices. You already have this kind of accusation being made in other circles as well. And there is also a statement here very much against conservative discipline, against biblical discipline, against a parent's right to discipline a child, and specific illustrations given in the book. It's a wake-up call for all of us. We got the lights lighting up here, folks. The phone lines are getting busy. I think there are a lot of you who want to talk about this, and frankly, that's a relief. If you didn't want to talk about this, I was going to be really concerned about whether anyone is willing to speak on behalf of parents out there. But there's still the opportunity for you to call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. The question, should parents be licensed? If you say yes, by whom? By what criteria? For what reason? Who's going to make the decision? Who's going to yank the license? Who's not going to get a license? Lots to talk about. I'll be right back. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
the best of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Should parents be licensed? That sounds like a very remote question. I mean, after all, there is no proposal right now that I know of before a legislature. It doesn't look like something that's about to become public policy. But these are the kinds of ideas that have been filtering through certain communities and professions, especially in the academic world. And, you know, it's reaching the point that this is no longer just something that that is abstract and unthreatening. This is the kind of idea that, especially with new reproductive technologies and new abortion regulations and all the rest, becomes a real question. And there are those who are suggesting that natural procreation by a couple, and specifically by married couples as well, should be limited by state action and thus controlled by a license. It is a frightening proposal, but it follows the logic of those who want the state to control every dimension of life. And who, in the name of creating a child-friendly environment, would subvert parental authority. That I stand by my position, that the ability to procreate is indeed one of the most important checks against the totalitarian power of the state. Let's go to Chris calling from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Chris, go right ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have to say I'm not totally against the idea. While I don't think the state should have any say in it, some against it in that state, but I've worked with kids. I'm a youth counselor, and I've seen kids in horrible situations by parents who don't deserve to be parents, who are kids. These kids are being abused right and left. And so I see some validity in it.
Well, you know, follow that through with me, though, Chris. If you said you don't want the state to do it, who would do it?
Right. Well, what I'm saying is I don't think it's the worst idea ever. I don't know who would do it. And obviously, I don't think it's going to happen because I wouldn't want the state to do it.
But you're concerned about kids. And I understand that. I hear your passion for kids. And you know, that's why we do need courts to be ready to intervene where there are demonstrated cases of physical abuse and where obviously children's lives could be endangered. And so there's no question about that. But the question is where the prejudice lies. Is the court's prejudice towards parental authority and then it just violates that under extraordinary circumstances? Or is it against parental authority, in which case the parents are virtually forever on trial? Appreciate your call, Chris. Good to hear from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. We want you to call as well, folks. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Liz, listening on WFIA-FM in Louisville. Liz, go right ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Mueller. I do want to say that the absurdity of this, especially whenever you said, well, what does an unlicensed parent do when they find themselves pregnant? But I wondered if you might make a comment on, I question my Christianity views on welfare situation. Where a mother just keeps having one baby after another, and I wonder about some kind of regulation in that area. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, you know, this is one of those things that we have. You know, we're reaping what we have sown, Liz. I think in a very clear sense here. And let me tell you why. With the rise of the welfare state, whenever the government comes into a situation, it creates incentives and disincentives. I mean, that's true in terms of the housing market. The tax break for the mortgage deduction is an incentive the government's put in place for people to buy homes. That's important for the economy and all the rest. So that's where the government said we want to create an incentive. There are other situations in which the government creates a disincentive in order to keep people from doing something. And then there are other cases in which they create what are called perverse incentives. Now, track with me here for a minute, Liz. That means that that by establishing a particular point of public policy, they can actually encourage bad behavior. And that's what's happened in the welfare system. When you start giving more money to people to have more kids out of wedlock, they do so. And that's a perverse incentive. In other words, the government basically is subsidizing sexual promiscuity and having children out of wedlock. And I think that is something that should be of concern to every single citizen. And yet, by the way, to mention this is politically incorrect. And obviously we're concerned about those children and we're concerned about those people, but we should not be subsidizing bad behavior. But we're living in a society that says, who is anyone to say it's bad behavior? Now, when it comes to licensing, I have to tell you, I think there's a greater danger that such a licensing program would be used against people on ideological grounds than on economic grounds. Because I think we've reached the point where this government says, hey, we don't care how you connect with each other. We only care about what you're teaching your children and whether you're getting with the program here. And that's not so much in the government as in the bureaucracy. That's a big thing. Now, that's the government, but not so much in terms of elected officials, but in terms of the long-term bureaucrats. Just read their mail. Read their documents. It's scary stuff. We'll be right back. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Well, you know, there's a danger in talking about something like this that people can immediately run with it and think there's some specific policy proposal out there. You know, I think a fair question to be raised is whether or not I think this is really something that's likely in any near-term future. Parents are going to be required to have a license. You know, and the answer to that would be no. I just don't see that right around the cultural corner here. But I'll tell you what short of that is happening that makes this conversation important. Essential to this idea of licensing parents is making parenthood a privilege rather than a right, and suggesting that parents ought to have any sort of outside authorization in order to keep and raise their children. Because what we're seeing right now is the genuine, unquestioned encroachment of the state and its bureaucracy and its agencies into the life of parents. And, you know, you already have proposals in certain areas about, well, certain countries have made spanking illegal. And other countries have said there have to be certain educational choices made. And, you know, just parental authority is being compromised all over the place. And it is I would argue, conceptually, a fairly short jump to get to at least many of these proposals, even if they're short of an outright license. But I got to tell you, there are people out there who are actually pushing for this licensing requirement. I mean, after all, Professor La Follette's book, written 25 years ago, was published by Princeton University Press. And this new book, Should Parents Be Licensed?, edited by Peg Tittle, T-I-T-T-L-E, includes people who teach at Harvard and all over the place. It's not just a group of people who are, you know, out there on the Internet somewhere. These are serious proposals being made. I want to know what you think about it. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Jack, calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Jack.
Hey, Dr. Mueller, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Glad to hear from you.
Hey, I just wanted to make the point. I appreciate you bringing this up, but I think a lot of this discussion is based on parents today that have faith are better parents, and society really supports not having faith and not doing the things that's essential to raise children correctly, and so it causes the problems with bad parenting, and now they want to come up with a different solution to that's not faith-based.
Yeah, so, you know, Jack, you're onto something there. Let me tell you, you could go to certain educational conversations where teachers and administrators and those who would influence them are found, and you would see them talking about parents as the problem. And that's another book I'm going to be writing about soon, by the way, by an educational advocate. I picked this up at the University of Chicago just a few weeks ago, arguing that parents are the problem, really trying to help teachers know how they can teach around the parents to control the minds of the children. And we're fooling ourselves if we don't think there are people out there trying to get our children to pay attention and trying to have the influence over them that parents should have, and even trying to subvert parental authority. Certainly that's something that a totalitarian state tries, and it's also something that an omnivorous culture tries, as there are those who are the self-proclaimed experts who would like to have control over our children. Thanks, Jack. Let's go to Jeffersonville, Indiana. Eric's on the line. Welcome, Eric. All right, we lost Eric. We're going to go to Nathan from Birmingham, Alabama, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Nathan, go right ahead.
Dr. Mueller, I appreciate your comments past Sunday on that judicial Sunday.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Anyway, just wanted to tell you, you know, these same people that are probably proposing this are probably the same people that want to stand behind same-sex marriage and all the other attacks against the home and family. And I just think it's terrible to see the society trying to step in and define the roles of parents and define the roles of marriage, and it's just ultimately them wanting to take God's law out of the picture.
Yeah, and it's a rebellion against the very structure of creation, don't you think, Nathan? I mean, it's one of these situations in which what you see is a revolt against the obvious. That's the way I often try to put it when I'm talking about it. Let's just take the picture. Now, what you have here is a real revolt against the idea that there is a normative picture. But, you know, the scripture is just real clear. There is a normative picture. Here's that picture. A mother and a father who are committed to each other in the covenant of marriage, who welcome children and raise those children according to biblical principles. That's the normative picture. And, you know, society should not interfere in that process unless there is some clear and present threat to those children, a physical threat. Otherwise, the parental authority should be respected and parents should be encouraged. And, of course, you have in the New Testament, in the book of James, a very clear warning concerning the fact that parents ought to work. You also have in the Johannine epistles, you know, a very clear word. And in Timothy, you know, about such things. In Timothy, Paul goes so far as to say that a man that won't take care of the needs of his family is worse than an unbeliever. And that's very important for us to know. And so the church needs to encourage parents to fulfill their responsibilities. But the prejudice has to be towards that normative picture. That has to be. Social policy should encourage that normative picture and discourage the undermining of it. But we're in a topsy-turvy world now, and Nathan, you're exactly right. Let's go to Melissa calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Melissa, welcome.
Oh. Yes, I am against the parental license. I'm a foster parent, so I see the children that are coming out of the court system, and regardless if they have a license or not, it's still going to happen. And you're still going to get parents that are going to break the rules, and we just need to have a society that puts God back in it, and we have churches and people that are in those churches that, you know, get into politics and, you know, make law rather than putting godless people making the laws for our country.
Now, Melissa, let me ask you a question. You're a foster parent. Do you realize that you probably couldn't be a foster parent in California? Because there, in order to be certified as a foster parent, you have to sign a document stating that you will not teach children that homosexuality is wrong. Is that frightening to you?
Yes, it is, because here in the state of Tennessee, you know, they want us to teach our kids morals. They want to teach the foster kids morals. They want us to take them to church. They want to make them a part of our family. However, when it comes to the parents that they were taken from, they don't have to have morals. And so, you know, California has taken it all the way to the very end, and yet, you know, here in Tennessee, you know, we are required as a foster parent to teach right and wrong, but the parents that they were taken from aren't required to learn that.
That's a great point, Melissa. Thanks so much for your call. It's great to hear from you. You know, this question about licensing parents, it's one of those things which at first blush just makes you kind of blink. You know, could someone actually be proposing this? But this is the kind of proposal that is being taken seriously in some parts of the world. And right now, for instance, in China, there's a one-child policy in which that totalitarian state says you're only allowed one child. And after that, there are serious disincentives. And we know that has led to infanticide and abortion and sex selection abortions and all the rest. It's easy to say that couldn't happen here. And, you know, I think as a matter of legislated public policy, this is unlikely. But I think in terms of the direction that some of our courts are headed and the intention of the bureaucracy, it's hardly an idle threat. If it's not a license, it could certainly be a very clear form of social sanction that would undermine parental authority. I'll be back with some final thoughts. This is the Albert Miller Program.
This is the best of the Albert Miller Program.
So where do we stand now? Well, you know, I think we're in a situation in which, legally speaking, we need to think of the direction of our courts as towards tentative parental authority or conditional parental authority. Because I can tell you right now, there are an awful lot of family court judges and academics and think tank intellectuals and all the rest who are arguing and in the courts debating and in the legislatures even defining parental authority such that the parent has authority until the state decides the parent doesn't. And, you know, right now it can be over abuse cases, and we clearly understand that the state has not only a right but a responsibility to intervene where there's a clear and present danger to a child. But we also know that that's now being misused, so that parents who are simply disciplining their children according to biblical norms are in danger of having their children taken out or of having their parental authority compromised. We know that there are parents who've made educational decisions about their children and health decisions about their children. And there are children's rights activists who are coming out of the woodwork to suggest that the child has the autonomy to make such decisions. And just remember this, parental authority is already almost universally in the states been taken away in terms of a question like abortion. And yesterday, the House of Representatives passed a very important piece of legislation which should strengthen parental authority in the abortion question, parental notification. But, you know, you can imagine how that's going to end up in the courts. Because right now, according to the prevailing law and court decisions, a teenage girl has a right to an abortion, and her parents don't even have the right to be consulted or informed of the matter. And, you know, so don't tell me that parental authority is not under assault. We know it is. And it's a part of the big picture. And what is the big picture? The big picture is that the normative picture is being erased. It's being dismissed as an Ozzie and Harriet or a Beaver Cleaver kind of picture. And I'm not concerned with Ozzie and Harriet. I'm concerned with the Bible and what God would give us as the picture of what he intends for us, for our health, for our holiness, and for our good, our happiness. You know, as parents, we face a good many challenges, and most of us are just busy doing the parenting. And that's why on this program, I'm going to try to bring to our attention some of these issues out there that ought to be on our intellectual radar screen. And those of you who are high school students and college students, this would be a good issue for you to kind of research for a paper sometime or an essay. And, you know, it's not good for one side to be engaged in this debate. We need to be there, too, and not just defensively, but there with cogent arguments and with a solid understanding of why we hold these beliefs about parenting and children and family. You know, one of the most disappointing parts of this book is that there's a prejudice against children in the first place. You know, in fact, the editor says having children is not always good. Well, there's a sense in which I can understand what she can mean, but not the sense in which she means it. Read my commentary at albertmoeller.com, and we'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Moeller's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.